Today we have an Ask Auntie Lila question that I got at a recent talk I gave. Very simple question from a mom. My son is 13 years old. Should I get him a phone? He's a little lonely. He's a little shy. He'd like to be connected with his friends. Is it a good idea? I kind of feel like he should have one. What should I do? Should my child have a phone or device? Auntie Lila says, no. Okay, I get it. Here are the arguments for getting a phone. This is how friends communicate today. They text each other. They message each other. The coaches get in touch with them this way. They get texts about games and practices and drills. And their teachers maybe text them and they just need to feel connected. A lot of them have apps. Some of them are on Instagram or TikTok. This is how it's done. Also, maybe this way, this homeschool child could be playing some computer games. Well, really, no. Let's talk about it some more.
Welcome to the Home Truths Good Cheer Society. In the world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Gospel of John, chapter 16, verse 33. For those who don't know me, I'm Lila Marie Lawler, Auntie Lila. I'm the self-appointed collective memory curator. I write about competence, learning some skills of homemaking, and why we should do all those things on my blog, Like Mother, Like Daughter, and in my books, including the Summa Domestica, Order and Wonder in Family Life, which is a 3-volume box set, available at Sophia Institute Press. I'm all about the restoration of home in brightness, warmth, and joy.
You know, my children are all grown up now, but my eldest, who honestly is a middle-aged man now, did come of age in the time of Nintendo and computer games that everyone played on the connected to the TV. And we just never really allowed him to do that. We did have a few computer games on our very new computer. Of course, the computer at that time was a dial-up situation. So it was just literally a computer game, not anything interactive. We did that sometimes, but in terms of playing video games with friends, that this was going to be their means of entertainment, no. And, you know, there were some times that I was ready to kind of cave in because I did think to myself, well, you know, this is how they get together with each other. This is how the friends connect. But my husband was always very firm. Later, when this child went to college, he did say to me at one time, you know, you were right. It was better that I didn't have computer games. So it's not that I'm out of touch. It's that we think that things are new because we're adults. We think that things have changed. But I'm here to say that children and their development has not changed. Children are the same. A child born in the time before Christ, a child born in the Middle Ages, a child born in 1860, a child born today, those children all need the same sorts of things. They need the same sorts of interactions and education, and they develop the same way. Even if our culture changes, even if we ourselves become aware of different things, that does not change what a child needs to be developing properly. If we talk about what kids can do together, what kinds of things this son, this boy, could be doing with, for instance, his dad, because the reason I bring that up is because a lot of dads today play video games. So it's hard for dads to put their foot down because they themselves were raised playing video games. But I think as adults, we think about it and we really think there are some things maybe we did in our more immature phase that we need to stop doing because now we have children. Let me give you an example. It could be that when you were in your 20s or your husband was in his 20s, or your wife was in her 20s or in college, that one of you or both of you were in the habit of using swear words. It's kind of normal-ish for people to swear, and they're used to letting some expletives fly, especially if things don't go right. It's a kind of self-control thing. You drop a hammer on your foot and that word just comes out. And then when you have a little baby, there's no reason necessarily to stop. So you continue. And then one day you have the two-year-old in the back seat and the car doesn't start and you let go with a choice juicy word. And then from the back seat, you hear that word repeated back to you. And then you realize, oh yeah, I need to stop using those words because I care about my child and I want my child's vocabulary to be formed well. And I want him to be a person who can express himself with a wide range of vocabulary. And so I myself have to learn how to speak in a more elevated way, or at least not in a vulgar way. There are actually a lot of things like that. As we become parents, we confront them in ourselves. We overcome certain things. And I would just say that playing video games is one of those things. So then the question becomes for the father, well, what could I do with this son? I'm going to have a lot more suggestions later on, but I just want to throw out there right now. Hey, how about going for a hike? How about playing a board game? There are lots of other things that you could do together. I bet you can look around the house and say to yourself, yep, this son and I, there are some repairs we could be making to this house. There are some loads of substances out in the yard that need to be put in the wheelbarrow and moved from one place to another. And that will give a good opportunity for some talking with each other. And just also sometimes we could just say peaceful, silent companionship. And with friends, it's the same. Well, the friends get together and they play video games. Well, they could do other things. They could go and toss around a football or play pickle. Perhaps the money invested in computer games and devices, which are not cheap, could be tucked in the bank. And then some of it, a little part of it, could be used for a secondhand ping pong table, for instance. Things like that. It's important for us also to look at the interaction with nature. I think that most kids today are much less in contact with nature than children of any other age. And that's reflected in a lot of things I read recently, that children's dictionaries now have a huge percentage of words replaced, words that relate to nature replaced with words that have a more technical aspect. They're more about computers and social media. Well, that's rather disastrous, because nature is one of the tried and true ways that we have of coming into contact with reality, of accessing beauty, and of becoming aware of God's presence. So it's very important that our children be in nature as much as possible. So I would say, though, that there is really one extremely important reason not to connect a child of any age, and then particularly in adolescence, to the world in the relentless way that devices present. And that has to do with the much bandied about word and idea of bullying. And bullying has become something of a political idea, and that can sometimes make some of us who are more traditionally minded not really think about it and unpack it and understand it in today's context. The thing about bullying is that it has always existed, because one of the things that children naturally do, and I don't mean naturally in a good way, just part of unredeemed fallen nature, is to form groups that essentially are mob-like and to seek out the weakest links and pile up on them. And this is because, I mean, there are lots of psychological reasons for this, but a big part of it isn't even about any stark reasons in the makeup of the bully, like psychological makeup or anything like that. It really has to do with human nature, that when human nature is not constrained, it tends to seek to exert power. And that's what children do. And they will take any difference whatsoever. It doesn't matter. If you had 30 children and they were of the same ethnic background and they kind of sort of looked the same or what have you, they would come up with some difference and then they would attack that difference and they would find the person they perceived as the weakest person and they would go after that person. So that, since it's part of our fallen human nature, it really has always existed. And again, I just want to say it is not to address the political aspect of this. It's not necessarily even related to, you know, a certain current idea of what the weak person is or what the victim is. It can be anything. As I just want to reiterate, it could even be just that one child has brown hair. And so that's what they'll go after. So it has always existed. And I wouldn't even say that overall, I don't want to excuse it at all for the fact that it always has existed. I will say that it is not completely negative, because when a person has been on the receiving end of bullying, in the sense that maybe those of us who didn't grow up in the connected age think of it, it has this redeeming quality, which is that later it does give the person, for one thing, empathy for those who have been isolated for one reason or another and who have been attacked. And it is important to have that kind of empathy. And sometimes those experiences are given to us so that we can understand them and use them in our future life to be able to relate more to people and not to be proud. It also offers the person a chance to stick up for himself. And I think that this is something important to teach children, by the way, that if they are bullied, I mean, obviously you want to try to address the situation, but it, as I say, it is a reality. And sometimes it's important to just take the child aside and to say, you can stick up for yourself and you might lose. But the truth is that if you show you're willing to fight in an extreme situation, even if you lose, the bully will have respect for you and likely will leave you alone. That's kind of the classical approach to bullying. It's the approach that my husband took with our children, to just say to them, you know, sure, like sometimes you just turn the other cheek, sometimes you just walk off, ignore the person, don't let them get under your skin. But if push comes to shove, be willing to stick up for yourself, get in a fight, and even if you get in trouble for getting in a fight, we will stick by you. And even if you lose, trust me, the bully will be beaten back. The bully will have respect for you and leave you alone, because one thing about bullies is they are cowards. They don't like to receive kicks and blows, even if in the end they win. But, and here's the but, there has to be a respite. It cannot be that we expose our children to a 24/7 vulnerability to attacks by the mob. And that is what we do when we give them a device. When we give our child a device, we are artificially amplifying what the tendencies of the mob, the bullies, the children who will gang up on other children can do to our child. And when you hear a story of a terrible story, they're so heartrending, of a child who has been, today, you know, we hear these stories, the child has been bullied to the point even of committing suicide. You have to really question what the adults in this situation were doing, because the only way that it gets to that extreme end, which is the most extreme it can be, is if that child had no escape, no respite, no shelter. There has to be an end to escalation. And in the past, that end was that the child came home and the bullies couldn't reach the child at home. Sure, maybe during the school hours at recess, let's say there was ganging up. Maybe the child even really got tormented. That happened. That was not good. But because, let's say in my childhood, because things were pretty strict and because the child was occupied for pretty much all the minutes of the day in school with the teacher's eye on them. And even at recess, there were monitors who organized games and kept an eye on people and didn't allow wandering off. There was a certain limit to what could happen to you. And maybe you'd be walking home. And I remember my mother saying, you had to walk together in a group. You couldn't be walking by yourself. And in the back of her mind was, it's not really fair to a child to get them into a situation where they're isolated, because then yes, bullying or even worse can happen to them. So these were the practical things that the adults in the situation did to make sure that children were more or less protected. And then if bullying occurred, it was considered more or less a part of life that was at least limited. Sure, you can't have oversight into every single thing that goes on, nor would you really want to, because it's just not reality. But for the most part, there was a chance for that child to escape. With connectedness, there's no escape. There's no time that you could just think things over on your own. There's no time to be with someone in real life, an adult who you think might help you, your mother, your father, your older brother. There's no one, there's no time for you to take that person aside and say, and have them maybe ask you, so how are things going? And then you have a chance to say, well, not great, because there is this relentless messaging. And even if the messaging isn't actually happening, the child's mind is on the device and even in the device. I think we all as adults know how the device can kind of monopolize our attention, even when it's always on probably, but the volume isn't up or what have you. Even if we set it aside, we can still kind of hear it vibrating. Or in our minds, we think, well, did I get any messages? Are people kind of attacking me for that post that I made or what have you? That's too much anxiety to put on a child. The child should be completely free of that. It was interesting that I had another question from a reader about the boys who were her son's companions. And she was remarking and asking me about the situation that she found them in, which is that at the age of 12, they seemed to be communicating with each other a lot about having crushes on girls, and this seemed to be occupying a lot of their time. And she was asking me if I thought that that was normal. And of course, these children did have devices because they quote unquote needed them to be in contact with coaches, etc. And, you know, I even asked my husband about this. I'm kind of like, I mean, I have raised three sons. I've known a lot of little boys around the age that she's talking about, around 10 to 12 years old. And yeah, my husband agreed. This is completely abnormal for little boys to be focusing on and obsessing about crushes with girls. This is something that is an artificial atmosphere created by being able to talk about it, i.e. messaging at this rate, because it could be that, you know, once in a blue moon, an 11-year-old boy says to another 11-year-old boy something about a girl, she's cute, whatever. But for this to be the dominant topic is not normal. It is not usual. So we're even losing sight of what normal development is due to the prevalence of these devices. Now, as to coaches and the other activities that supposedly need to be the subject matter of direct text to the children, I just have something that I hope is a wake-up call, a question to ask that I hope strikes you in a way that helps you to gain perspective, which is this. Since when do we allow adults who are not part of our family circle to communicate directly to our children? And by definition, if our children have their own devices, often without our knowledge. I have to say that this is something that has arisen kind of simultaneously, well, or let's say it arose with the advent of giving children devices. Oh, well, now we have a handy way to communicate with children, and then nobody really questioned it. But then during lockdown, it became even more so. And in fact, even in real life, it started to be, as things opened up a little bit, that parents, in their zeal and excitement to get their children back to activities, accepted the idea that they were now going to drop their children off and not be allowed to go in to a certain place because of perceived ideas about safety and what have you. But if you think about it, 10 years ago, we would have said, no, I'm not going to drop my child off and not be allowed to go in and set eyes on this person who's talking to my child in an ongoing fashion. I am not going to have my 4-year-old, 6-year-old, 8-year-old, 10-year-old interact in an isolated fashion with an adult. And, you know, I was thinking about this and I was thinking, okay, well, I mean, we've always had children alone in classrooms with teachers. Certainly the teacher had access to our children. I'm thinking again of, let's say, my childhood, where I think for the most part, parents did drop their children off at school and not really check in. But I think I can say that for one thing, society has radically changed, and especially the teaching profession, which, let's say, up until the 60s attracted people who genuinely cared for the formation of children and who were part of the community and who were accessible to parents by being part of the community. And subsequent to that, with radical educational philosophies entering the mainstream, you started to have the teaching profession be perceived as a means of forming children apart from the parents' desires and principles, and sometimes opposed to the parents' desires, wishes, and principles. And I know that even as old as I am, I had a teacher in fifth grade who was much beloved by everyone who knew her. She was extolled as, and actually was, the most interesting teacher in the school, and had good control over the classroom and got good results from the students. And yet that teacher, I can attest, in 1972, said to our class, which of course she had complete access to, she was totally alone with us, as I think we all accept happens. She told us that she did not see any reason why two women who loved each other couldn't get married. And at the time, that seemed like a really strange idea to me, but I trusted her and I didn't really think about it. I didn't know exactly what she meant. It didn't seem right to me, but I didn't talk about it to anyone. I don't think that any parent knew that she had said anything like that. Now, if that could happen then, I think that we should be realistic about what's happening now. And in fact, in lockdown, that's exactly what happened when students started to be remote. Parents started to overhear what was happening in the classroom, started to look at how the teachers composed themselves, how they dressed and how they acted, and started to realize, oh, maybe this is not a good idea for people with these ideas and notions and ideologies to have direct access to our children. And so a good portion of the population has somewhat woken up to that. But yet I feel that we're in some sort of schizophrenic mode where if someone says to us, well, I'm just going to be texting your child about updates, that we accept that and we're okay with it. But actually, I think we need to address it and we need to say, no, if my child needs to have information about a sports schedule or drills or practices or what have you, that information needs to be filtered through me, through the parent. The coach can text me. Now, when a child gets to be the age where he really is off with his friends, for instance, they're driving, they're going hither and yon or what have you, maybe then it will be appropriate for him to have a dumb phone, to have some sort of device, let's say like an Apple Watch that simply allows for that kind of direct communication and cannot go to the internet, and there's no viewing of YouTube videos or what have you. Perhaps. Although I will say you have to really check this out all the time. You have to know exactly what's going on. And especially for that watch idea, I would say that it's very important to realize that something is on your child's body and is alerting him to something is going to have a significant effect on how he perceives the world and what his imagination is doing when it's supposedly at rest or should be at rest. And just think of ourselves. Just think of how we feel when we hear our phone buzzing. What if that's actually on your body? I mean, maybe you're carrying your phone in your pocket or something and you realize, yeah, I'm like actually getting a shock. I'm getting some sort of little ping and it's doing something to my state of consciousness. Well, for a child, it is amplified in an exponential way. And we really need to take responsibility for that. So if we're going to give something like that, even to an older child, we really need to insist that when the child comes home, that thing gets put into a basket and the child has time away from it. Rest time, certainly. Let's not have any such thing in the bedroom. The bedroom should be the place where the child can completely relax, can read a book, can think his thoughts, and can be at peace. All of that goes to a child younger to the nth degree. I hope that I really can impress this upon you. There is something that happens to the very being of that child if he thinks that he is somehow completely vulnerable to outside influences. All the time. It's just simply not good for him. And we have to do what's good for our children. Now, I have to say that we have to also, instead of just approaching the whole thing negatively as like, here's something the world is handing to us. Do we accept it or not? And then saying no. And having our whole attitude be one of resistance. I think that there's this whole other side to it, which has to do with what we can do to build, rebuild, and recover a normal culture for our children. So this is going to start with speaking to other parents, with sharing information with them about the detrimental effects, such as the ones I've been speaking about, and maybe you yourself have other ones. And I would really encourage you to share them in conversation with me. You can certainly always email me at LilaMarieLawler@gmail.com to give your feedback about what I'm saying and other examples that you have. We need to share these things with other people. And I really suggest sharing them in a way that's kind of like, yeah, does this bother you? And have you thought about this? And what do you think? I wouldn't say that we should go to people and just give them a diatribe or a rant about it, because I honestly think that most people have not really thought this through. I think they accept that this is the normal way of communicating, you know, but it's funny because I even remember as a child, and I'm talking about the time when phones were on the wall, and not only that, there was no call waiting and there was no voicemail. So you'd get a phone call or you'd call your friend, and naturally you'd want to talk. And so you'd be on the phone there talking. And of course, you know, the phone was in the kitchen or what have you. And I remember my father just saying, first of all, if he was going to get a call, it wasn't going to come through because I was on the phone. So he wanted me to get off the phone. But the other thing is, you know, it was disruptive to family life because I'm having a conversation, one side of which everyone can hear, but they certainly can't hear the other side. And that's actually kind of rude. And then the other thing is that he very wisely just told me, I mean, after 10 minutes, he'd start, you know, that's enough time to get off the phone. And he would talk to me and he would say, you know, it's really not actually a way to get to know someone. And it's fine to talk for a little while, but after a while, it becomes very unreal. So, you know, I was saying that people are accepting that this is the way we communicate with each other. But I think the wisdom of those words can apply today, too, that maybe this is kind of a false kind of communication, or it could be a valid kind of communication, but not if we extend it too much. Because at some point, maybe we have to realize I'm kind of talking to myself. And that's not actually healthy. So if little by little, we can just kind of talk to people about this, not so much give them the rant about why we're all wrong to do all these things, but really try to activate and awaken the part of their mind and conscience that maybe has been bothering them a little bit when they think about how their children interact with them and how, what kinds of conversations they have with their children and whether they're interrupted or not. And just say, like, does that bother you? Are there things that you think about when you hand your child the phone? And yeah, let's talk about it. We need to build a community where children can relate to each other without devices. And I really mean build that community. So think about how children develop. Think about the fact that the world is throwing its priorities at us, but we have to set our own priorities. So we have to set our standards for what good development is at each stage. And maybe we have to read up a little bit about that. I have resources for that on my blog. And really sit down and think and make a list of the good uses of free time. So for instance, let's go back to that question that came up with the 13-year-old boy. Suddenly, he should be playing. So he should be playing sports, very important, of whatever level of formality appeals to him. And I mean, I think a quick glance in our minds about it will give us the gamut, but also just playing. I mean, my sons had great games all through their teenage years because it's so funny because, you know, my boys are 5 years apart in age. So I have three boys and there's 5 years between the first and the second and then between the second and the third because there were girls in between. But they all played together pretty well. And because my youngest son had, you know, those plastic army guys? We had a couple of buckets of those little plastic army guys, super cheap. Buy them by the bag at the store. I stuck them into some buckets and wow, those army guys proved to be a great investment, let me tell you. And it was so funny because the teenagers would bring out those army guys. You have to have a good amount of them. And they would have setups all over the house of, you know, various battles or what have you. And it was so funny because it became very interactive with them running all over the house. They had elaborate games involving all sorts of imaginative kidnapping scenarios and what have you. And sometimes they would even involve me. I mean, we're talking about 15, 16-year-old boys. If they got together in a big enough group and had no access to anything digital, they would come up to me and say, you've got to just choose one of us to be the kidnapper and one of us to be the victim, what have you. So I'd choose. And then this game would be inside, outside, all through my house. And it was a tremendous amount of fun. Later, as I got a little older, they would start to play card games. They would play board games. They would go running together. They will do lots of fun things if we just close off this avenue of digital stuff. There's crafting, there's building, there's, as I said, being in nature, there's certainly reading. And the truth is, you're not going to read if there's the easier, lazier way of looking at your device. There's singing, and for boys, the key to singing is campfires and also all-boy choirs, if possible. There's drama, getting up plays together. There's dancing, especially square dancing. Now, that's something that would not naturally necessarily occur to boys, but if the community has dances and kind of lays down the rules for the boys will go along with it and they will have fun because square dances and line dances and contra dances are quite active and really fun, especially if you have a bonfire afterwards. The boys will be up for it. They're serving at the altar for boys. They're serving in the community. They're just thinking. So we have to ask ourselves, is this the sort of daily living we want for our children? Do we want them to be creative and or bored? Because boredom isn't the worst thing. That's when you pick up that book. that's on the shelf that you've been eyeing for a long time? Or do we want them just to be on a spectrum of mindlessly scrolling to actually being at the mercy of people whose identity we don't necessarily even know? What is home life like? Do we ourselves need more texture, more interest? Do we need more creativity? Do we need more poetry? Do we need more reading aloud? Do we ourselves need to detach from our devices and pick up a book that we know will appeal to our teenagers and turn the lights down, light a few candles, and start that adventure story? Should we all go out for a walk together? Visit with friends? Make things? Garden? Making maple syrup together? Another important thing in a child's development is that he gains situational awareness. And I find that when children are completely habituated to using devices, they have very little situational awareness. And it's because it starts when they are supposedly unruly toddlers. I've seen many a time on an airplane that the child is handed the iPad and okay, it's one, maybe, I don't know, maybe it has to happen for like that dismal hour when you don't know what to do with him. I don't know. Somehow the rest of us managed without that. But surely when the child is getting on the plane, surely when we're all getting ourselves situated in our seats and looking around, surely at that moment, he should not have his nose in the device, because it's a time to say, look around you, look at the people, take note of them, look out the window. What do you see down there in the tarmac? What do you see as we're taking off? What do you hear? This is the beginning of situational awareness and what we think of as behaving. A young toddler, a four-year-old, behaves a lot better if they've been helped by their parents to take note of what's going on and think about it, what's around them. Maybe if they develop that habit, they will be able to pick up on the little whispers from God. And that's what we really want for them. But if they don't have silence and they don't have that sense of needing to be still so that they can use their senses, they will be less likely to be aware of God's voice. As parents, we need to make an effort to offer a peer group and friends, and this is especially the case for teens. So through our educational situation, whether it's homeschooling or that we've chosen a good school for the children, we need to be proactive in facilitating the peers and those conversations that we've had with the parents, whether we're just standing at a game and chit-chatting on the sideline or what have you, standing in line waiting for pickup, taking a hike with others, that we've had those conversations, that we are choosing friends whose children also are being raised with some sort of standards. And these will be the good peer group for our teens. We'll make a good home, which is a place where people can land, can feel relaxed. Let's say on the way to somewhere else, like if they're going on a big trip, that, oh yeah, gather at my house and they can hang out and have some pizza and maybe play a quick game of some sort. Sometimes there's a kid who needs a meal going from one place to another. Let's have them over to our house to do that. And let's have our home be open before or after activities so that we can demonstrate and provide for the kinds of use of time that we see as healthy. So, you know, when I say talk to your friends, I do actually have a plan for that. And I've written about it in my book and on the blog. And I call it the St. Gregory Pocket. You can look that up, what that is. It's about how to make friends in order to set, you know, with the long view of, well, hopefully we'll get a peer group for our children too, a community where our children will not be outliers and will not be just the weirdos who don't get devices, but where other parents are kind of like, yeah, we don't, either we don't allow them or we restrict them, or yes, we see the value in these other things. So we call those St. Gregory pockets. And one aspect of it is to have get-togethers with other moms, other dads, or couples together where you can actually read something and discuss it. And I like to suggest that you read something that really is oriented towards these topics that I'm discussing of family life, development, how to make a community that you really will feel that is trustworthy, and especially to provide opportunities for the fathers to get together and make a plan. It all hinges on the father being the leader and laying down the law, because the mother will waver. But if the father just says, nope, we're not doing that, then it can just be fine. Dad said no, and now I just don't have to deal. If you all agree in your community that you won't give phones, you're all set and you have nothing really to fret about. I guess what I want to say is, when we look all around us and we complain about things, what's the use if we ourselves don't set the standards in our homes? I mean, for instance, we complain about porn. It seems like 9 out of 10 men in our society use porn. What? And we're thinking, you know, we deplore the fact that even 7 and 8 year olds are seeing porn. But what's the use of complaining about it if we ourselves are giving devices to our children? If we are doing these things, how can we expect people who've never really thought about it or have no formation or no access to any really solid information, if they don't, how can they do what's good for their children? We're the trendsetters. We're the influencers. So let's be brave. Start by talking to your spouse. Wife, say, husband, what do you think? Husband, say, you know, I'm thinking, I really don't want this to happen in our family. Talk about it. Again, talk to your friends. What do you think? Is there a way for us to do this together? Is there strength in numbers? Would you be interested in coming over, having a cocktail and discussing this with us? At school, to go to the authorities in school and say, can you meet with us? Can you support us? Can you help us set standards? It isn't just that we ourselves should resist worldly things, we should, but it's also, we have a world to make. It's the salt that gives savor. It's the leaven that leavens the whole mass of dough. A few people just saying, yeah, no, we're just not going to do that, that really does start us on the path of creating something good and wholesome. And that's just a really great gift to give to people. And it can be done. It's a gift to give to our children. It's a gift to give to ourselves. And it's a gift to give to others. Even if you had to do it alone, it's worth it. But I bet you don't have to do it alone. Stand firm. You can do it. Auntie Lila says no. But Auntie Lila also says, build something beautiful in your home and your community.
In the words of our patron, St. Thomas More, to his daughter, Margaret, farewell, my dear child, and pray for me, and I shall for you and all your friends, that we may merrily meet in heaven.
Thank you for joining us for this podcast. This is Phil Lawler speaking for the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture at Thomas More College. I hope you've enjoyed this presentation. And I hope you'll register on our website to receive information about future events hosted by the Center. If you find these recordings helpful, please help us to continue our work by making a tax-deductible contribution. We cannot continue to provide fine programming without the support of people like you, and we're grateful for your help. To receive updates on our activities or to make a contribution to our work, see our webpage at RestorationChristianCulture.org. That's all lowercase with no spaces or punctuation. RestorationChristianCulture.org. Thank you again.